News Center.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, a minibus travelling to a hen party in Liverpool has crashed with a lorry, killing one woman and injuring 17 others. Six air ambulances attended the scene on the M62 in West Yorkshire, which was declared a major incident by the emergency services. The driver of the lorry has been arrested. Assistant Chief Officer Dave Walton is from West Yorkshire Fire and Rescue Service.
Our control very quickly realised that we would require attendance of vehicles over and above what would ordinarily be a response to this. The crews that arrived described to me a very difficult scene, some of them saying it the worst they'd seen in a number of years, and some very experienced fire officers have been attending this incident as well.
A terror cell which plotted mass murder worse than the 7/7 attacks has been jailed. The ringleader, 31-year-old Irfan Nasir, will spend at least 18 years behind bars. The rest of the Birmingham gang have been sentenced to a total of up to 72 years for their part. Assistant Chief Constable Marcus Beale is from West Midlands Police.
They wanted to commit mass murder, cause significant harm to others and a whole lot of fear on our streets. So they were extremely dangerous and we are considerably safer with them being imprisoned in the way they have been.
Two men who posted photos online claiming to show James Bulger's killers as adults have received suspended jail terms. An injunction prevents people publishing anything revealing the new identities of John Venables and Robert Thompson. Syrian government officials have denied the use of chemical weapons against rebels. It's after a video emerged reportedly showing the aftermath of an attack. The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and Prince Harry have been visiting the studio where all the Harry Potter movies were made. The royals were taken on the Making of Harry Potter tour and even learned how to use a wand. That's the latest. I'm Jenny Lyne.
The Jelly Records Bristol Acoustic Music Festival.
BCFM.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Helping us review this week's news is the leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, councillor for Whitchurch Park, Helen Holland. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Filton Tory MP and Freemason Jack Lopresti changes his story about last December's jolly to Saudi Arabia. He didn't meet with human rights groups after all, but was representing British arms manufacturers. The Boston Marathon bombs also, as cracks start appearing in the story of last Friday's dramatic car chase by Boston police. And chemical weapons in Syria, is it Iraq all over again? And also preparing for Acts of Terrorism Act. This is the today's revelation that the Birmingham terror cell will be discussing that too. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 3 Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, highs up to 9, sunnier on Saturday than on Sunday, and some light showers over the weekend. Highs at 16 degrees Celsius next week, some light rain on Monday, but the rest of the week looking fairly sunny. Next weekend, that's the 4th and 5th of May, highs of 13 degrees Celsius and fairly sunny for the May Day rally in Castle Park on Saturday. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, it's local elections next Thursday, with elections across two-thirds of the city, and you may have noticed we've had Lib Dem, Conservative, Labour and Green councillors on over the last few weeks. But they're not the only parties standing. Some wards have candidates for the following parties. That is the Birthday Party, the Trades Union and Socialists Against Cuts, or Tusk. Also, Independence for Bristol, and finally, the UK Independence Party. Now, democracy is all very well when it works, but after electing councillors and MPs, are they there for you when you need them? Well, I've been compiling a list of city slackers over the past 2 years of politicians that don't return phone calls or emails requesting that they come on this programme, or have simply refused point blank to come on the radio. So, are there any city slackers standing for re-election? Well, if politicians have unavoidable commitments every Friday between 5 and 6, I'll offer to move the time to a pre-recorded slot or do the news review on the phone with them. So, in my book, the city slackers are those MPs and councillors who've either stonewalled, that is to say they're prepared to do the show and then won't reply anymore, or simply won't communicate at all. Now, I realise MPs and councillors are busy people, so each has to be contacted at least four times by phone or email, usually twice or three times by each method. Politicians may well think there's no point in coming onto this show. After all, we're only little community radio. And also, they may think going door to door and talking to you face to face is the best way for you to vote for them, of course. No, the problem is, if a politician doesn't return calls and emails, most won't even explain why. How likely are they to deal with the questions that elect them? So of the six city slackers up for election this time, four are Lib Dems and two are Tories. Most of those are standing down. They are two Lib Dems, Bev Knott and Patrick Hassell, and two Conservatives, James Stevenson and Alex Pearce. But that leaves two Lib Dems who are standing again. That's Simon Cook in Clifton East, representing the Liberal Democrats in Mayor Ferguson's cabinet, and Cheryl Ann in Horfield Ward. Simon Cook sometimes replies to my communications, but only to say that he can't do it. After about 20 attempts, still won't say when he can. And when I bumped into him recently, he said, well, you just have to keep trying. As for Cheryl Ann, when I finally got through to her, she simply told me she didn't want to go on the radio. So that's your two city slackers who are standing for re-election next week, both Lib Dems on Mayor Ferguson's cabinet. Simon Cook standing in Clifton East and Cheryl Ann in Horfield. So, helping us review this week's news is leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council and councillor for Whitchurch Park, Helen Holland. Hi, Helen, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony.
Just briefly introduce yourself by explaining, what is your role as a leader? You just tell everyone what to do?
If only. No, all of the political groups on the City Council and in other local authorities elect a leader from amongst their number. And obviously, I represent the Labour Group at some events, some meetings. Others, I'm in my representative role as the Whitchurch Park councillor. But I think tonight I'm here as the leader of the Labour Group, but also as an individual councillor as well.
Now, many people say that when New Labour were in power, the last government, Thatcherism was continuing. Tony Blair was a big, enthusiastic fan of Margaret Thatcher, in fact, was carrying on his legacy. And that whilst you had the opportunity to change the country with all these Labour ideas, you didn't actually take it. So why should anybody vote for you?
Well, I think that, you know, people may say that, but actually it's a bit like, you know, what did the Romans ever do for us? Actually, if you look around Bristol, you look around this country, there were massive changes made in the 13 years. Obviously, the party made some mistakes and there are some things that Labour Party members weren't comfortable with. But you've only got to look, you know, right where we are today at the investment in the infrastructure in schools, for example, in Bristol. Every secondary school completely rebuilt. I've been out in North Bristol today. You look at the Southmead Hospital progressing. We've got the South Bristol Hospital. So it was in bricks and mortar, but it was also in things like civil partnerships, like the minimum wage, all of those things that came in under Labour. And actually, I think that we were in a lot better state then than we are now, where some people are really beginning to feel very much the pressure of the impact of the policies of the coalition.
So why didn't you do something about it as a party whilst you're in power?
Well, I think we did. That's what I'm saying, that I think that an awful lot was changed. You think of things like tax credits. I know that the other parties like to discredit those, but actually putting additional money into the pockets of people who were working was the right thing to do. There was also redressing the balance about making sure that that women had decent access to decent benefit levels. So I think there was an awful lot done. But if you remember, we inherited the country in quite a bad state in 1997, and there was an awful lot to do. If I think about Bristol at the time under the previous Tory government, we used to get money for schools that came literally in thousands of pounds rather than the millions that we had for the schools rebuilding programme under a Labour government.
Now, we've had Len McCluskey this week at Unite, I think he is, talking about, with the Trades Union Congress, about a possible general strike. He also says he thinks if they carry on like they are at the moment, Labour are simply going to lose. And there's a poll out last Saturday in The Guardian, which seems to agree with him. There's a little chart in front of me. me here, the state of the parties, looking at the intentions of voters, and literally over the last year or so, Conservative has been going very, very slowly down. UKIP's been going up. Lib Dems being about the same. Labour, literally in the last 3 or 4 months, has been going right down. They're now at 35%, I guess, against Conservative at 29% and heading upwards.
Well, I think, you know, you can see different polls tell you a different story.
Now, well, what about this poll? Well, you know, it's easy to say that, isn't it?
But in that poll,
we've got a poll in a sympathetic newspaper saying that actually in the last 2 or 3 months, Labour has been heading straight right downhill.
Well, Labour is still ahead in the polls. Perhaps it isn't ahead as much as we would like it to be, but we've got, you know, there's going to be elections in a huge number of county council seats and in 2/3 of you, as you've already said, of the Bristol wards next Thursday. And that will be an interesting snapshot of where Labour stands. But I think that one of the things that people expect the Labour Party 2 years before a general election to have all its policies done and dusted. But then if we did that, the National Party would also be criticised for not listening to the electorate. So I think that the policy review that is on at the moment is the right thing. I think it is getting pretty close to the time when we ought to be very clear about what our national policies are. But I'm not disheartened by that poll at this point in time.
Most worrying of all, it says in this poll, and I will stress, this is in The Guardian, you know, which is supposed to be a Labour-supporting paper. Well, most worrying to all Labour may be the findings on the economy. In September last year, 26% of people said they trusted David Cameron and George Osborne most to run the economy, whilst 24 preferred Ed Miliband and Ed Balls. So what people don't trust Ed Miliband and Ed Balls with the economy. They actually trust, at least more people do, trust Cameron and Osborne. Well, even at this stage.
I think that, I mean, I would contest slightly what you said about The Guardian being a Labour paper. It's certainly a left paper, but I think if you look at the last election and what they recommended to people to do, it certainly wasn't to vote Labour. But one of the things about Cameron and Osborne, Ed Miliband and Ed Balls, is that a lot of this is shrouded by the cult of the personality and the way that Ed Balls, I think, in particular Ed Miliband to a slightly lesser extent, is portrayed in the media, actually gets in the way of people hearing the message about what they are saying about the economy. And consistently, actually, Ed Balls has been shown to be right. The forecasts that Labour made have been right. George Osborne has had to admit he's wrong. We're now, just yesterday, triple dip recession. This is not a good place for the coalition to be, and yet
Just yesterday, he managed to squeak by without having a triple dip recession. Yeah. Only just. And it may be that next month it does, you know, or next in the next quarter it does become a triple dip recession. But you should be winning that poll at the moment, and you're not. You know, we're halfway through a government in opposition. You should be able to do that. You know what? Who's getting your votes? It's UKIP. UKIP are surging.
Well, that's one interpretation. But I do think that, you know, talk of triple dip recession. How many people out there listening to your programme know what a triple dip recession is? I mean, I have to confess that I would have to kind of look up the actual, you know, definition of the term. But what people do know is that unlike some of the other economic cycle arguments, this is really hitting, what's happening now is really hitting people. It's really hitting women in particular. The jobs that are lost, there was an interesting report I was looking at earlier this week, the jobs that have been lost in the public sector, by far the greatest proportion of the people who've lost their jobs in the public sector are women, and women are being very badly hit by things like the bedroom tax, which I think is a wicked, wicked policy, and wicked I'm using in the bad sense of the word. It's a dreadful thing, and when people come, as they do to my surgery, and describe the circumstances the way that policy is hitting them, you really realise that this isn't something that we talk about or we see on the news, but you think, oh, it doesn't really affect me. Actually, this is starting to affect everybody.
Okay, what about politics in the city? Why isn't the Labour Party engaging? Other parties are. They're in Mayor Ferguson's cabinet, but it's almost like a spoilt child. The Labour Party was saying, no, we're not having anything to do with it.
Well, that was a decision that was made last November, and I've only been the leader of the Labour group since January. And I think what we have shown, one of the important things that we've had since last January, is Mayor Ferguson's budget, and what we were able to show through that process, that we were able to be a really responsible opposition, that we put forward propositions in our amendment to the budget, which actually the Mayor agreed with and took on board and amended his own budget before the council voted on its budget. So things like not seeing the drastic cuts, well, he was going to take all of the council funded police community support officers away, for example. He was going to make very bad cuts to community transport. There were all sorts of things that he was going to bring in, like parking charges at Blaise Castle and Oldbury Court. Those things, he actually listened to our arguments before the budget and changed his own budget to reflect the things that we were putting forward. So I think we've shown that we can be a very constructive opposition.
But isn't it better to be in there fighting, actually in the room, rather than standing banging your fists on the table outside?
Yeah. No, that's an argument that where there are very strongly held views on both sides. There really are two sides to this argument. And what we've been doing whilst we've been knocking on doors for the local election campaigns is actually to listen to what people have been saying about that.
Because the fact is, the voters have said, we don't want a party political mayor. So in a way, the Labour Party should be listening to the voters, shouldn't they?
Of course. And that is also a strong argument.
Even though he was in the Liberal Democrat Party right up until the election.
In the Liberal Party, I think it was before the days of the Liberal Democrat Party, because it was in the 70s. But it will be a decision for the new Labour group once the results of the elections are known. This time next week, we'll know what the shape of the City Council is. I hope that lots of people will be voting Labour, because they'll recognise that the stronger voice that we've got in the council, the more influence we can have.
Well, I noticed one of the things that the Labour group's been saying this week is that the cuts are going to bring a loss of £450 a head to Bristol in public spending for every man, woman and child in the city. Labour Party says calculations based on research into cuts show households are taking a double hit from the squeeze on local government and welfare spending. It says cuts in Bristol local authority area work out at £446 a head, £329 in social security, and £117 in just simple government cuts to the whole of the city. Regional average is £334. Nearby North Somerset sees cuts of £355, while Bath and North East Somerset and Gloucestershire will be less badly off at £290, roughly. Martin, what does this actually mean? What is the effect on the actual overall economy, and whether we have a recovery and that kind of thing, when the cuts are actually taking this amount per person away from people's spending ability?
Yeah, and you've got to remember that the knock-on effect, what's called the multiplier effect of these cuts, this is the first line of cuts. This is £440 per head. But then, of course, that money would then be spent in a local shop, which won't be spent. And there's a calculation of what the multiplier effect would be. But it's certainly more than the actual cuts. And as I've argued consistently on this programme, cutting welfare spending, whatever the rights and wrongs of it from a moral point of view, is economically illiterate.
But isn't there...
Because you're actually, what you're doing is taking demand out of the economy.
But you need to...
Which means that you won't, in fact, grow the economy, and therefore you won't, in fact, reduce the deficit.
But you won't. You won't... You need to incentivise people more to work, and then the economy can grow.
No, that's basically wrong. That's not, in fact, A-level economics, advanced level economics. And the Conservative Coalition have been able to bang this home. That we all know that you can't spend what you haven't got. We've all had credit cards and all the rest of it. Just wrong. I used to teach economics, and one of the first things you teach is, no, it doesn't work like that. The cuts, it's quite clear, as Helen pointed out, and as Ed Balls has pointed out, the cuts have not, in fact, reduced the deficit, and the deficit to GDP ratio, because the GDP has been stagnant or going backwards.
Well, they have. It's just been announced this week. The deficit is slightly down.
Yes, okay, but the GDP
it's at £130 billion a year, right, which is extra money that the government needs each year, which is being added to the national debt. But it is actually coming down slightly.
But the GDP has also come down, so the ratio of debt to GDP has gone up, and that is what your market traders are looking at in the city and elsewhere, in terms of whether you've got a credit rating or not, which is why they're losing the credit rating. Don't forget, and I interviewed Nick Clegg just after he'd been elected when he came to Bristol, all of this was in order to keep our credit rating. The credit rating is going because the policy is actually, as I said to Clegg at the time, the policy will lead to the loss of your credit rating, and you will lose. We've lost several percentage percentage points of GDP per year. Now, that is actually millions and billions of pounds. That's people's jobs. That's people's futures down the drain. And at the end of it all, we haven't, in fact, reduced the deficit by very much at all. And the deficit to GDP ratio has got worse. And in fact, this is a dead end. We're in a cul-de-sac. And they're trying to put lipstick on a pig and pretend that it's all right, but it isn't.
I mean, can I just endorse what Martin said about this mantra that has been going out about you know, you need to incentivize people to go to work. What is overlooked, and I know that those of us on Twitter, you see Labour people, left people will say it all the time, is one of the big things that's forgotten is the housing benefit bill, which is a massive benefit bill, but the majority of housing benefit money goes to people who are in work. It doesn't go to people who are just, you know, the caricature of just sat on the settee watching the telly all the day. They are people who go to work who are in low wages. And actually, it's a ridiculous situation where the state is subsidising people who pay low wages by giving housing benefit just to get people up to a decent standard of living.
And can I also add that the housing benefit doesn't in fact go to the claimants. It goes to the people who own the houses who turn out to be Tory voting double homeowners.
Well, not always. Some of them are the council.
Many are.
Well, hang on a minute, because Martin, of course, that is another area of problem, because that is one of the things that's changing through the benefit and the welfare review, is that, you know, again, the mantra is about giving people personal responsibility. So they are going to be giving people the housing benefit. And guess what? In the places that have already piloted these direct payments to the claimants for their housing benefit, rent arrears went up, the threat of evictions went up. So all of those things are greater cost to UK PLC, if you like. It just doesn't add up. It's a nonsense.
The other thing that's a nonsense, and this is something that New Labour contributed to in the last government, Helen, is the fact that the entire idea of Social Security was there to pick up people who couldn't work and couldn't get jobs for whatever reason. And that was always a tiny minority back in the days when it was devised, in the 1950s, the 1960s, and even in the 70s. Now we're in a situation where there simply aren't anywhere near enough jobs to go around. And I think it was the Joseph Rowntree Trust recently came out with the figure of 6.5 million people in Britain who are now looking for a full-time job. There may be more people who've got work, but for a lot of them, it's part-time work, and they actually want to work full-time. So whereabouts are these jobs going to come from? What's Labour's policy? I mean, this really put into this to you from a national strategic point of view, not just for Bristol. Yeah. Where are these jobs going to come from?
But again, it's about the wrong choices, isn't it? Because of the mantra about trying to reduce borrowing, things like that in our view would be perfectly legitimate and actually would make good social policy sense. So borrowing in order to fund infrastructure, housing in particular in this city, but in places all around the country. You know, you borrow to build housing, you get more people off the housing waiting list, you provide good jobs for people, you can get apprenticeships for young people in the construction trade off the back of those. And all of those people, you know, you end up with something that you need anyway, which is the houses, you end up with people in work, and you don't have this vast number of people who are looking for work. And of course, one of the problems, we all know what the problems are. You've got people, for example, graduates leaving university who are accepting jobs in shops, in call centres, jobs that would otherwise go to either people looking for their first job or people looking for unskilled work. And the whole thing has been skewed. It's a kind of race to the bottom, really. And there are people who, just to keep a meal on the table for their family, are having to juggle three jobs. This is just not the way to have in a civilised society. I know one of the other stories that we're looking at hopefully tonight is, and I think, you know, this is a disgrace in the 21st century, double the number of people having to rely on food banks. And we're not talking about food banks being you know, for treats. We're talking about people who literally, in order to be able to put cereal in a bowl for their children before they go to school in the morning, are reliant on food banks. What is that all about?
Well, good question, Martin. Food banks reliability. The BBC say over double. And I think it's The Independent says triple the number of food banks just in the last year.
Well, it's another sign of the social stress that the policies being pursued are subjecting us to. And, of course, the damage is cumulative. If and when Labour comes back to power, all of this cumulative damage will then have to be addressed before we can even get back to where we started before the coalition took over. I mean, the
Helen's talk, what she's just talking about building houses there, is all pie in the sky, because there's no money.
The point is that you can run a deficit, which is what we've argued all along, and we are running one anyway. And of course, the other thing you've got to do is reboot the tax system, and there is a debate to be had about how to do that. But during the Thatcher era, for example, the top rate of tax for most of that era was 85%. 85%.
But she brought it down almost immediately.
No, she didn't. No, she didn't. She didn't bring it down till the end of her term. And in actual fact, Britain in the 1950s, for example, when most council houses were built by a Conservative government, by the Macmillan government, had a top rate of tax of 93-94%. And of course people say, you can't have a top rate of tax like that. You can, and the sky didn't fall. It was perfectly straightforward. We've got used to the idea that the wealthy do not pay their way and therefore there's no money. But in actual fact, the wealthy have become far wealthier since the 1950s. They've got an awful lot more money than they had then.
I'm doing a bit of fact-checking. You've got your facts wrong about the deficit. Reuters, this is. UK budget deficit barely falls in 2012-2013. More pain ahead. The government's preferred measure of public borrowing, which excludes some effects of bank bailouts and a one-off Royal Mail pension transfer, fell to 14.2 billion pounds in the tax year. This equates to 7.4% of GDP, down from 7.9% in 2012-13. So it is very slightly down. Nobody's saying that we're not borrowing a ridiculous amount of money every year to add to the national debt. That is happening, but the deficit is slightly down.
Yes, but the point is that their strategy is out. They've been way blown off course here. There is absolutely no way that they're going to be able to stick to what they said they were going to do when they got elected. And that's because the economy is flatlining. And don't forget, there's every possibility with the euro crisis, with the fiscal cliff in the US and all the rest of it, we could have another 2008 crash. And then all of these figures will just be blasted out of the water. And that, of course, is a really scary prospect.
And Helen just mentioned food banks, and so did another Labour MP, that's Robert Flello, in the House of Commons, at the first Prime Minister's questions for, gosh, it seems like almost a month of all sorts of various different holidays, the Thatcher holiday, Easter holidays, and finally this week they're back.
Last year, 7,400 people across Stoke-on-Trent needed food banks, including 2,600 children, just to stop them starving. From this week, due to his welfare changes, the food banks have been forced to restrict food only to families with children and only to people over age of 65. Isn't it true the Prime Minister has failed Britain and his big society is overwhelmed?
Prime Minister. Well,
I'm very disappointed in what the Honourable Gentleman says, because it was the last government in 2003 that gave to the Trussell Trust, really the organisation behind Britain's food banks, gave them a Golden Jubilee Award for voluntary service. And this is what, and I'm glad to see is in his place, the Right Honourable Member for Sheffield Brightside, he said this. He said it was an outstanding voluntary activity that has enhanced and improved the quality of life and opportunity for others in the community. Look, of course these are difficult times, and of course food bank use went up 10 times under Labour, but I think we should praise people that play a role in our society rather than sneer at them.
Yes, well, he made the point there, David Cameron, Helen, that 10 times the number of food banks under Labour.
Well, I think this is one case where you actually can look at true numbers rather than percentages, because if you think about what this means, whether it's two or three times the number now in dependent on food banks, it's a huge number of individual lives. And David Cameron can say all he likes, oh dear, you know, it's terrible that people are dependent on them, but it's not something that's going to affect him. He doesn't know what that feels like. I can tell you that in the food bank that's out in my area, the one that's run at the Witherwood Centre, that more often they run out of food before the queue has gone these days than than not. And so if that doesn't tell you something, I think it's an absolute disgrace.
Well, one of the other questions that quite often gets asked at Prime Minister's questions is, when are you going to visit a food bank? We didn't have that one this week, just for a change. Martin, more than 350,000 people turned to food banks for help last year, almost triple the number who received food aid in the previous year, and 100,000 more than anticipated, according to the Trussell Trust.
Well, that's a massive increase in 1 year, isn't it? And that shows a trend, doesn't it? That larger number, and basically going to food banks is not something that people do easily. There's quite a lot of stigma associated with it and so on. So for it to double in a year just shows what's the pain that's out there. And the situation is getting worse and could get very much worse, as I hinted at earlier. And the government basically is on autopilot and they've just got their fingers in their ears going la, la,
well,
la.
Chris Mould, who's the chairman of the Trussell Trust, says although it's established 345 food banks, the Trust says there's insufficient capacity nationally and that between 400 and 650 more food banks are needed to cope with expected demand. It's opening new projects at the rate of three a week, but says geographical gaps in the coverage means thousands of people are facing hunger today in towns with no food banks. The rise in numbers of people using Trussell Trust banks reflects a 76% increase in the number of food banks set up over the past year. Well, isn't it possible that actually the fact that there's so many more of these been set up, that that's why there's so many more people using them, that in the past they wouldn't have been able to?
Well, this probably requires investigation and research, but I would suggest to you that if you double something like that in a year, that is a sign of social stress. And that what used to be the case, that we had a welfare system which protected people from this kind of penury. Basically, their benefits were supposed to cover their food costs. They're clearly not covering their food costs, are they? And that, in fact, is a sign of failure by the government. And it's not a sign of success. We could all go to food banks. Let's all go and beg in food banks, because why don't we put everybody on the dole and cut the dole, and we'll all go get our food from food banks? It's a cul-de-sac. There's no way out there.
Okay, back to Prime Minister's questions, and another one that crops up fairly regularly is, will the Prime Minister personally benefit from his tax cuts for the rich? And this one popped up again this week.
Ellen Jones,
Labour.
Prime Minister be kind enough to tell the House how much he will benefit personally from the scrapping of the 50 pence tax rate.
As I've said before, I will pay every appropriate tax, but like everybody else, every single taxpayer in this country is benefiting from the rise in the personal allowance that we've put in place. Everyone can benefit from a freeze in the council tax. Everyone can benefit from what we've done on fuel duty, and everyone would pay the price of another Labour government.
Well, again, he will not answer that question, will he? Helen, what are your thoughts? Do you think he will benefit personally, Mr Cameron?
Well, of course he will. And this is one of the problems, isn't it? That as Martin says, they pretty much are absolutely stuck in a course. It's been pointed out to them by their political opponents, i.e. us and others, but also by think tanks, by academics, by commentators, the IMF, yes, most recently, that this is not working, but they are absolutely stuck in that groove, and they're not going to change. And part of that is, of course, that because they only talk to themselves, they're, you know, Cameron is from a very privileged background, as is Clegg, and so they talk to people that those policies do benefit. They aren't talking like local councillors are to people who are really, really suffering. And you know, to an extent, Cameron saying that the freeze on council tax works for everybody, it does, but these things are proportionate, aren't they? We're talking there of a couple of pounds where people are losing tens of pounds in their benefit, and a couple of pounds to people on Cameron's money doesn't mean anything.
Well, another similar question also, I mean, trying to give Mr Cameron every chance to reply to what is essentially a sort of law of the jungle question. It's like, well, we're in charge, so we will run the country for our own personal benefit kind of question. This one was from Stephen Hepburn.
Stephen Hepburn.
Labour.
Bangor's bonus at £15 billion. Executive boardroom pay up by 27%. Tax cuts for millionaires, tax cuts for wealthy corporations, and the ordinary members of the public have got to pay for it. When is the Prime Minister going to represent all of the people in the country and not just his privileged chums?
Well, I tell you what this government has done. It's taken 2 million of the lowest paid people out of income tax altogether. It's delivered a tax cut for 24 million people. It has frozen the fuel duty. It's freezing the council tax up and down the country. And if people want to make an impact, they should vote Conservative on May the 2nd to make sure they keep their council tax down.
No, I mean, one thing you can say, Martin, as David Cameron replied there, is that 2 million people have been taken out of tax completely. Now, that, for those 2 million people, is fantastic.
Yes, but also, of course, the universal credit means that they may well lose a lot of that back in, of their benefits and so on. So there's the question about who this is extremely disputable. Also, of course, everybody above £10,000 gets a tax cut. So the wealthy get it as well, which, of course, then means that it's much harder to close the deficit. Oh, yes, that would be right then. Incidentally, of course, in Norway, the question of how much was David Cameron worth and how much tax did he pay would be absolutely there on the internet, because everybody's tax returns have always been public property. So the whole idea of I'm not going to tell you how much I earn and how much tax I've paid, in Norway, a socialist republic, if you like, with a king, everybody knows. And of course, once people know what people actually earn, the question of who pays what tax becomes much sharper than it is in Britain, where it's too, we don't want to be rude and ask people exactly how wealthy they are, because gosh, we don't want to know that kind of thing, but we need to, don't we?
Helen, aren't you trivialising in a way, actually 2 million people being taken out of tax completely? They've achieved what you could never, as a new Labour government previously, could achieve.
Well, I think, you know, for the reasons that Martin said, this isn't, it's a very easy figure for David Cameron to trot out, but when you ask people about what the impact of the combination of welfare changes, the tax reduction only affects those who are in work. We've already said there's over 6 million people who are looking for a job. You know, I think that it's trading figures which. The thing that galls me, as Martin's already said, is that the tax bonus, if it isn't a tax bonus, sorry, the tax cut that David Cameron talks of, by far benefits wealthier people even more. So to those that have, they get even more.
Okay, on to a local story in the compromise deals. This is in last week's Bristol Post. Bristol City Council spent nearly £1 million paying off staff during the past 5 years. The compromise agreements are usually, well, you see, this is where the Post gets my goat sometimes. They call them compromise deals, whereas everyone else seems to call them gagging clauses. The City Council's responded by saying agreements included those with schools, not just the local authority, were never intended to prevent whistleblowing, but actually these compromise agreements include gagging clauses that prohibit people from speaking to the press, for example, about anything that was involved in the process by which they were sacked. Helen, you know, as someone that's intimately involved in the council, what are your thoughts about this? Because in nationally, Bristol's top of the whole country. We do more of these gagging clauses than anybody else in the country for our former council employees. And surely, if someone has been employed, they should have every right to talk about what went wrong in the council and why they were sacked, if they want to.
Well, I mean, I saw this story, but it's not something that I've got any knowledge of myself. You know, I've never been made aware of any of these compromise agreements that have been signed with previous employees. So,
well, let me just give you an example. Right, one is the coroner. About 2.5 years ago, the coroner was sacked for speaking out about, which apparently he did it inappropriately, but then he wasn't allowed to actually speak to the press about it, otherwise he would lose his severance pay and all these kinds of things. And some of his staff were also had to sign these clauses in order to get what should be theirs by right. They're having to sign away their right to speak out. Well, what about you, Martin?
Well, I mean, in principle,
we're top of the league around the whole country for gagging clauses.
Well, in principle, we want transparency, don't we? But of course, this also highlights what the expenses involved with it, with sacking people. It's not a cheap process. In actual fact, you often end up with spending more money getting rid of people than you would by keeping them on.
Well, I can tell you what at least one of these people, I can't tell you who it is, from the coroner's office said, is you've now got a puppet coroner. If they were allowed to speak out, that's what they would say. And that's rather worrying, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, the point is that we want transparency, but also, you know, there are legitimate reasons why certain things are kept confidential in certain lines of work. And, of course, each of these cases is going to be individual, so it's very hard to comment, especially, you know, and that's one of the reasons why it's difficult to say anything constructive.
Well, Charlotte Leslie has been very outspoken about this. That's a Bristol Conservative MP. She says it's an absolute disgrace that Bristol's at the top of the National League table in gagging its employees from speaking out, so at least she's prepared to speak out about it, Ellen.
But I think one of the things that this story, from what I saw of it, slightly confused or conflated was these compromise agreements in the NHS, which have been shown to stop people talking about unsafe practices in the NHS, and that is a very worrying thing if those agreements are used. So I think that Charlotte Leslie, in her own quote, she said, you know, that similar NHS staff have been prevented healthcare professionals from highlighting practices which could have put patients' lives at risk. And that's been debated, as I understand it, in the House of Commons. And I think there's a bit more a general agreement that within the NHS, this is not a good thing to not be able to have transparency about things that are going wrong.
Well, what about in the coroner's service for, say, somebody that's died in hospital in mysterious circumstances? Surely it's quite important that people like that are able to speak out who've lost their jobs in the coroner's service.
I can't comment on that.
Well, I understand when we had Gary Hopkins on here talking about this, he said that as he understood it, it was actually Kenneth Clark's, it was the Justice Department that insisted that the coroner had to go, because they said it wasn't actually the council's decision.
The council made an initial decision, and then it was appealed up to Westminster, yeah. And Kenneth Clark made the final decision. The whole thing dragged over a long, long period of time. But I want to, you know, certainly it seems to me a basic tenet of all of this is that if people have worries about the way the service is being run, they've got to be able to speak out about it. Anyway, on to another local story, and First Bus have banned CND adverts in Bristol, and I'm going to play you now a clip from Dialect, which is on 2 o'clock on Friday afternoons, another programme I do, with Hannah Tweddle and Rose Crossland, both from Bristol CND, talking about this ban. It's a campaign going on about Trident and about the £100 billion, which is about to be spent on Trident. And the CND had asked to put adverts on buses in Bristol. In fact, the National CND was just about to pay for them. And at the very last minute, just before the campaign started, First Bus came back to them and said, no, you can't have these adverts on First Buses. So let's have a listen to that little clip now.
National CND arranged to advertise on buses across the country as part of that tour. The adverts are being carried on buses in other cities, but not on First Buses in Bristol. And they rejected the advert at the last minute with no mention before of any problem with the slogan, which was something along the lines of,
if we cut nuclear weapons, we could spend £100 billion on healthcare, transport, housing, education and energy. So a simple, objective statement of fact.
They've not responded to our letter yet to explain why they refuse to carry them.
Yeah, so that was Hannah Tweddle and Rose Crossan from Bristol CND. Martin, this is a little bit naughty of First Bus, isn't it? To just sort of say to them, no, you can't have this advert on our buses at the last minute.
Well, indeed it is, and it may lead to a situation where when First Bus's contract comes up for renewal, you might say, well, you're not acting in the public interest. We want a company running our buses.
But then they'll say, but our bid is less, so we've got to have the contract.
But if they are making political censorship part of their project, then that is open to question, isn't it? I mean, you know, why are First Bus running the buses anyway and deciding what can and can't be shown on buses? I mean, that's a very good question. And if they are, in fact, using their market power to censor political points of view, I think that's a very strong mark against them.
But they may be planning something like, they may like the idea of nuclear power buses in the future. They might be trying to stop CND getting anti-nuclear messages out.
I would argue that people who are carrying out a public service like providing public transport should not be in a position to censor sponsor people who are basically legitimately pursuing their political objectives.
Okay, there's £100 billion about to be spent. CND wanted to raise awareness around Bristol about it, about Trident, but they're not allowed to, Helen.
Well, I do think it's a little bit extraordinary, because presumably CND were going to pay for the adverts.
Yeah, of course.
As I understand it. And that clip seemed to indicate that other bus companies in other parts of the country had used the adverts.
They've been running around in London, for example. Transport for London had absolutely no problem with these adverts, pointing out the £100 billion of public money about to be spent on Trident.
Yeah, so I think it's an unfortunate decision because it feels a bit like an own goal to First, who aren't, after all, the most popular organisation in this city.
Well, a bit of money from CND might bring the fares down, possibly.
Well, I think it would take
a bit of money from Trident, maybe.
It might take a bit more than that, but I think it's a bit of an own goal for First, actually.
So, well, I mean, Martin, for example, CND have said that they haven't. They wrote a letter to First asking them why they will not run these ads, but they haven't got any reply.
Well, this is ridiculous. I mean, in the past, the bus company in Bristol would have been run by Bristol City Council. Transport for London is a public body. I mean, First Bus are in that role of being a public body, but they're not a public body, are they? They're A, profiteering, as everybody in Bristol knows, and B, they're also trying to censor political points of view. They're way outside of their zone of competence there. And, you know, it's not doing them any favours. They've got a pretty bad brand recognition as it is in Bristol, and a lot of other people are now going to say, well, this is another black mark against them, aren't they?
I think the only thing that I would say, though, of course, is that... You know, were it that they were having adverts on the buses for the BNP, for example, we would obviously be very annoyed about
that. But comparing the BNP to CND is a bit unfair as well. The BNP are breaking various regulations of incitement and so on. Yeah. CND are not doing.
All right. Well, perhaps that was a poor choice of an example, but there might be things that they would advertise that other people would feel, offended by. So I can understand that they've got a policy about whose adverts they take, but I'm very surprised that CND fall foul of that policy. Let's put it that way.
Well, keep
explained what it is yet.
Keep listeners informed. Well, the CND have promised to let me know if they do get a reply to their letter from First Bus as to why these we're not allowed to see adverts saying £100 billion is about to be spent on Trident nuclear submarines and missiles. I'll keep you informed about that.
Well, First are on this charm offensive at the moment, aren't they?
Are they really?
With their questionnaire about the fairs, so, and I know that they're going to be appearing in sorts of public places with a stall about asking people what they think about the buses and about the fairs. So perhaps some of your listeners, if they come across one of those stalls, might like to go and ask some of the First employees about the CND adverts.
Yes, I certainly will as well. Right, the Big Four accountants are using knowledge of Treasury to help rich avoid tax. This is a story out in the Nationals today. Experts offering advice on legislation. They helped to create this ridiculous conflict of interest, says committee chair, sector committee chair Margaret Hodge. The so-called Big Four accountancy firms, Martin, we do talk about them quite a lot on here, don't we? They are under investigation at the moment by the Competition Commission for price fixing, are using knowledge gained from staff seconded to the Treasury to help wealthy clients avoid paying UK taxes, a report by the influential Commons Public Accounts Committee says. Deloitte, Ernst & Young, KPMG and PricewaterhouseCoopers have provided the government with expert accountants to draw up tax laws. So these financial firms are drawing up tax laws, but the firms went on to advise multinationals and individuals on how to exploit loopholes around legislation they had helped to write.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about this earlier. I mean, we used to talk about poachers becoming gamekeepers. So, you know, gamekeepers who used to be a poacher can be quite a good gamekeeper. But now we've got the gamekeepers becoming the poachers. And, of course, there ought to be a fairly clear dividing line between private sector and public sector activity, especially if public sector, things like the tax collection. You shouldn't really have a revolving door of tax consultants from the private sector coming into the public sector tax setup. And, of course, people say, well, just, you know, they've got the expertise and so on. Yes, but there's a conflict of interest. There's a conflict of interest, and that should just not be happening.
Helen, what are your thoughts about this? Because at KPMG, which is, as Ian Fraser, who was on this programme, is the former business editor of the Scottish Sunday Herald, I think, was on here talking about KPMG being the worst of these four, he was suggesting. We have now got in Mayor Ferguson's charmed circle a volunteer advisor from KPMG. So it's almost as if we've got a mini version of what's been going on here with the Treasury in our own city council. His name is Matt something. But anyway, what are your thoughts about this? It looks as if these big accounting firms are actually in there drawing up the laws and then deliberately, possibly even deliberately writing in loopholes that they can then pass on to their wealthy clients who are actually paying the bill. A lot of these people are in there as seconded into there, and they're not even on the government civil service payroll.
Well, I heard this story this morning, and it's funny that Martin used the analogy about poacher turned gamekeeper, because somebody on the radio got into a very convoluted, it's not just the poacher turned gamekeeper, but then inviting the poachers back to look where the pheasants are, and and so it went on, because it's very, very convoluted, isn't it? Because you've got people from professional accountancy firms who are being seconded into the government, so we're not absolutely certain who they are, because they're not on the government's payroll, because they're being seconded from their firm to give advice about new legislation on tax. But at the same time, what they would say is other arms of their business are also giving advice to big firms about, somebody made great pains on the radio this morning to say they're not obviously doing anything illegal, but they are being able to, we know the story of Starbucks, don't we, earlier this year, and this kind of scam that they bought their coffee in Switzerland, that well-known coffee-growing country, so that they didn't have to pay tax on that, and they've got various other ways of making sure that their tax bill was as low as possible in this country. So I think that Margaret Hodge and her committee are absolutely right to highlight this. And I think that the way that the Treasury spokesperson that I heard this morning on the radio just kind of poo-pooed it and brushed it aside actually wasn't the answer that the question merited, because I think this is about transparency again, and we do need to know who gives the advice, which bits of those advice are taken, and what else do those people do?
Well, you talk about transparency. I've requested for the Bristol City Council, through the press office and through the mayor's office, to grant us an interview with Matt Payne, this guy from KPMG, who's the supposed volunteer, who's been helping Mayor Ferguson with his accounts and with the city's budget and other things. I mean, we're not really sure exactly what with, but anyway, he is in there. Matt Payne is. Martin, you talked about conflicts of interest. What are those conflicts of interest?
Well, to my mind, the tax collection agency of the government should be absolutely independent of the people that it's trying to investigate. If you've got a situation where the private sector seconds people who are not being paid to advise the government on how to collect taxes, well, they're also advising other people on how not to pay those taxes.
Well, of course, the other thing is they may not be subject to the civil service code, for example.
Well, exactly, and it's all under the table, isn't it? In any case, in principle, you should have the tax collection agency should be independent of the people that they're investigating. And of course, the idea that we need expertise from the private sector, the public sector needs to understand how the private sector does things. Things like this need to be publicly run and publicly accountable, and not, in fact, fudged with being in the private sector, half in the private sector and half out. And the government, in fact, they claim to be wanting to reduce the deficit, but they're actually reducing the number of tax collectors and people who investigate tax. Now, in actual fact, if you wanted to bring the deficit down, that's what you should do. Every individual tax collector pays for themselves in terms of the tax that they collect. So we're beefing up the welfare benefit people to try and chase down a few pounds. People, if they are fiddling it, they're fiddling a few pounds. Meanwhile, at the other end, we're cutting back on the people who actually investigate big companies for their tax bills, at the same time as pretending to bring the deficit down.
So could these big four tax firms actually be in the Treasury spying for their employers?
Well, the question is, as we had Rowan Boswell Davis on the other week, who used to be a fraud squad officer in the Met, is maybe all of these companies are basically big scams and they should all be in prison.
Well, what he was saying is that they were organised, identical to organised crime.
Yes, and of course, what would he know, having worked in the 12 years in the Metropolitan Police Fraud Squad? He's obviously an ignoramus.
Right, well, Marina Morris has been out on the streets to ask you about the local elections and to find out who you'll be voting for. So let's hear what you have to say about next Thursday's poll, whether you'll be voting, if you'll be voting, and if so, who for.
How important is a local election? Will you vote, and why?
Well, local elections are obviously very important so that we get the right people to represent us for the area. And my choice at the moment would be Labour.
I'm not really interested in, I didn't really live here, so I'm not really bothered by it. They're all liars. That's the only reason they're all liars.
I don't know nothing about it.
Same here, I'm not going to vote, I don't know enough about it.
I don't do politics, to be honest. It's not really an interest. I've just never been interested in it. It's not something I've been brought up with or anything like that. It's just whatever happens, it's going to happen anyway, so that's that.
I probably will for Labour. I don't know, I've just always been Labour, so...
Don't vote.
Not that important, no. Just because I kind of feel like you can't really change much in such a small area.
I'm not in this area, so I can't vote.
How important for you local election?
On a scale of up to 10, probably about 5. Just don't really feel it's that relevant really to me.
I won't vote, but generally speaking it is quite important for me. I don't live in Bristol, so I haven't really been paying much attention to it, but yeah, if I did live here and I did have a say, it would be very important to me.
I won't know. I don't know enough about it and I don't take enough interest in it, to be honest. I don't know how it affects me.
Same. I'm not even from here, so my local election, I've just moved. I've got no particular interest.
Yeah, they're important, yeah. Well, there's all the local issues. I'm interested in the local issue, like the state of the roads and things like that, and employment, things like that. Yes, Labour. I just feel they're the right choice. They've always been Labour from my roots, basically, so I should vote Labour.
Now, this is very unscientific, these vox pops. I would suggest possibly too many Labour people in there. But these are the figures.
I was thrilled with it.
The figures are that out of the people we heard there, 3 can't vote in Bristol, 8 won't vote, and 3 will vote Labour. Now, Martin, actually more of the people are saying that they either can't or won't vote than actually will. I mean, this is quite incredible. Yeah, well, 8 people, more than half the people we spoke to said they're not interested in voting.
If you look at the turnout in the mayoral election last year, it was around 30%. After all of the media blitz and all the rest of it, and how exciting it all was, mayor.
So why do so few people take any interest?
Didn't participate?
Why do so many few people take any interest in voting?
Because they've never lived under a fascist regime, aren't they the lucky ones? If you'd have a look at the war memorials up and down this country of the people who gave their lives for their right to vote, and if they can't be bothered, they can't be bothered.
I think one of the things that we've found, you know, there's been historically, although we are going to change it, but not until 2016, a very confusing system in Bristol. So it isn't even as if Martin's right. You know, the mayoral turnout was disappointingly low in any case. And that was with a lot of hype and everybody knew that there was a mayoral election. Some people still chose not to exercise their right to vote. But in Bristol, of course, some of the people that you might have asked when they said that they don't know anything about it, they might live in a part of the city where they haven't actually got elections. So the fact that you've got a confusing system, we've tried very hard, and it's great to hear that some people have said that they're going to vote Labour, because actually having a good community representative is really important. Somebody who is on your side, who can get things done locally, that is what people want.
But Helen, hang on a second.
Often get people who will confuse national with local issues. So they'll say to you on their doorstep, I'm always Labour, you know, we need to get Ed Miliband in, and this is the local elections. I mean, I agree with them that we do need to get Ed Miliband in, but that's not going to happen by virtue of the results next Thursday.
But I mean, all the people are able to do in local elections, really, it's putting your finger in the dike. It's whereabouts the cuts are going to be, isn't it? That's why people aren't that interested, because all they can see is it's just going to be cuts. And there was that one person very fatalistic saying, because we can't change anything.
Well, I think that what actually, it's a very good conversation that you have on the doorstep when you meet somebody, as I did the other night, who told me that she had never been interested in politics. She would have until recently have said, you know, I'm not going to vote, but because she's affected by the bedroom tax, she's genned up all about it and she is going to vote. So sometimes it's about how it affects you personally.
Okay, well, we're coming up now to the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest, leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, councillor for Whitchurch Park, Helen Holland. After the news, Filton Tory MP and Freemason Jack Lopresti changes his story about last December's jolly to Saudi Arabia.
On 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.